Glad to be here. My name is Chris Weifel. I'm an engineer, structural engineer. I've designed quite a few domes and working on domes since college, actually. I studied under Dr. Arnold Wilson. If any of you that have been around domes for any amount of time know Dr. Wilson or know of him. He's one of the pioneers in the monolithic dome industry for structural design. And so, anyway, that's a little bit of my background. I got a master's degree in structural engineering from Dr. Wilson. I studied thin shells and worked for a couple of firms in Las Vegas for a number of years. And then I picked everybody up, moved to Idaho, and that's where I live and work for myself now. So, a little background. Feel free to take one. They're kind of rough. I was rushing out the door yesterday. And I went to grab a card, and I didn't have any in the box. I had three, so I started photocopying them and then cutting them out. Well, they're kind of odd shapes, and some of them might be a little crooked. And then I just realized the fax number is an old fax number, so if you want to fax me something, give me a call, and I'll give you the right fax number. Welcome to an intro to dome engineering. This course is kind of geared towards residential stuff. That was my understanding that most of the people here would be more interested in that. I know that there are some commercial. How many people are here for a home? How many people are here for a church or a school or a? Okay. Very good. And so this class is going to look more at home design from a structural point of view, but I've got a few things in here from some schools, and we can talk about any other things that you want to for churches or what have you, larger diameter. We do plenty of large diameter stuff. I just take it more towards a smaller diameter home type thing. Does anybody have any questions to get started? And feel free at any time to if you have any questions or are unclear about something, just go ahead and ask. I mean, that's, if you don't ask a question, it'll be like 10 minutes. So, I'm counting on some participation.
Will you serve coffee and sweets after?
They will. I think next door they have some. In the All right. Now I got Dr. Wilson here. I'm going to have to actually. Let me get my other presentation out because it actually works. All right, why do you need engineering? Why do you need engineering on a house, per se? This is a picture from, it's kind of grainy, but this is from my master project. This is an 16-foot diameter dome. It's 8 feet tall, so it's got an 8-foot radius of curvature. And it's a half an inch thick. Okay, and we're putting a 7,500-pound forklift on top. Okay? If I was a little braver, I would have stood inside while I was doing that, but I'm not. And so we put this forklift on top, and it held up nice. The problem I had was I had a great big skylight at the top, and so I adjusted it a hair, and the wheel creased the dome. And then I put it back down and just turned it inside out. It was kind of fun. But think about that. You've got a 16-foot span with half an inch of concrete going over the top. And it was reinforced with chicken wire. You didn't have any virtually no reinforcing, just a little bit of something to hold the concrete together. We ran one steel wire around the base, and then chicken wire, and it was done in lift. So it's not even, I can't really tell, but I made a form, and then I would move it every day, move it around. So it's done in these 18-inch tall lifts all the way around. So it's not even a continuous monolithic dome. It's very segmented, and you can see there's some rough edges where the radius changed a little bit. See right there. That was a really interesting thing to me. Very exciting to see the strength that you get out of this much concrete spanning 16 feet. I did a quick calculation on that. If you were to use lumber, you need 13 2x12s spanning 16 feet to hold up the same forklift. So yeah, go ahead.
Did you just use sand?
It's just a sand mix, yeah. And I mixed it by hand, so
So you put it on by hand?
I put it on by hand, I mixed it by hand, and so the compressive, I don't even know what the compressive strength was.
And it eventually collapsed?
Yes, I rearranged the forklift, and as it swung back and forth a little bit, and the wheel creased the top, right where the opening was. As soon as it did that, I lost the shell. Which I had to tear down anyway, so it was fun to tear down that way. So speaking of that, why do we need engineering? We've got a very, very strong, very, very strong structure. Couple of reasons for engineering. A lot of times they're required by the building department. We run into a number of places where a conventional house is not required to be engineered, but they require a dome to be engineered because it's different and understand what and why they don't understand how strong it is and all of those things. So it's a requirement. You got a non-typical structure, you need to have it engineered. Another reason you want to be engineered, if you don't have that requirement, you've got peace of mind. Maybe you're not sold exactly that it is as strong as it is. You haven't been around them, you haven't tested them, so you want some peace of mind. Say, hey, I want somebody that knows something to look at it, so that I feel confident about it. The very most important reason to have it engineered, though, is, I can't stress this enough, this is very, very important. I have many mouths to feed, and so I need engineering because they're, I see they're still little. So, they get bigger, they eat more. Go ahead.
You could also have liability then, too.
You could have liability, yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's, you see that more with commercial type structures where, when they have certain bonding that you have to meet and different general liability and professional liability for insurance requirements. And so the first thing in your design is when you're looking at the house, what kind of design do you want? Are you looking at here's a simple design. There's a couple of very simple shells, with a little connector element. Nice. This is great. This is exactly what these people wanted. They named their home Ivory, which I guess is everything's all right. Jamaican or something is in the Midwest, and they just feel safe in it. And there's nothing wrong with these designs, but this is a very engineering wise, very simple design. There's a couple of openings, and that's all. Now here's one that's a little bit more complex. This one had three arches that came together that had dome ends, and at the very top they have this castle turret that comes up. And this one was kind of fun to do. And then we have one here. This one is in the planning stages, and it's very very intricate. Cut up, and there's a total of 20 domes, all of which have a different radius of curvature, and we're in the process of working out how to do this one. But so you got to understand, the simpler design is going to be a lot less money, obviously, and then the more complex and intricate you get. This home here is only 4,000 square feet. But it's going to be, the cost per square foot is going to be very high. Hold on, yes?
Can we decide, let's say you're not sure about size, can we decide so you can add it, let's say you have two domes, you can add it
for. Yeah, it's easier to add them up front, but we can definitely add on. We can, especially if we know that there's a possibility you're going to add on, we could add some reinforcing around openings and stuff so that it'd be easy to cut it out, or easier to cut it out later and add on. From the end of that. Oh, exactly. Yeah, if you want a passageway, or yeah, if you make a provision like that, then it's very simple to add. Right. So yeah, if you just come right off of one of these augments here, yeah, it'd be very easy to add on to it, not affecting anything there. All right. So what drives the design of the dome? Or any structure. We've got vertical loads we have to look at, depending on where you're at in the country. We've got snow. There's code minimum roof loads. Even if you're in Florida, you have a certain a certain pounds per square foot that you have to design it for because of miscellaneous construction loading or just because you have to. No one will ever be up there, but you need that. A lot of people will berm or bury their dome, so we need to take that into account during the design. And then any interior floors that are attached to the side of the dome, they're creating some bending in the shell, and they're also, we need to look at that for the footings. Horizontal loads, we've got wind loads, better known as wind seismic or earthquakes, depending on where you're at, and miscellaneous. We had a gentleman once that wanted a home in a floodplain, and so we designed one for him, and I don't know, I think this year, it's in Arizona, I think this year he might get tested. So, I feel confident the dome's going to stay there, but I'm not sure how all of his interior furnishings are going to fare through that. But, so we have to look at all those things. Now, you could say that, say wind, you know, why don't, you know, wind has a very small effect on a dome for the most part, especially a small diameter dome. Why don't we just design all of domes for 300 miles an hour, and then we'd be done. We'd, you know, we'd only need to design them once, and then we'd be everything would be, you know, we could use one standard design. The difference comes in when you start having openings, and when you do that, then your openings you're gonna really suffer with how to make those openings. Another thing that drives the design of the dome is what is the end use? Is it a house? Is it a church? Is it a school? We use a different factor of safety for a church or a school than for a house because we've got a lot of people or children inside. So we want to make sure that we have that added factor of safety for any sort of, especially against buckling or any sort of occurrence. Right? We need to take care of. It's just, you know, the same thing that you would do within a conventional building. They require that schools or, you know, places where you're going to assemble a lot of people be designed to a higher standard. Here's an example right here that we're in the middle of right now. It's a high school in Geronimo. It's in Oklahoma. Boy, I hope you can see that a little bit better. But we have three different sized shells. And this, can't see it on the, this one's like 80 feet, almost 80 feet in diameter. And this one's 110, and this one's 140, I think. But what you can't see is, like, right up here, both of these are 3 inches across the top, 3 inches thick. And this one down here, we've got 4 inches. Now, it'd be real close. This one would actually work at 3 inches. But since it's a gymnasium, they're going to be hanging the scoreboard off of here. And they're going to be hanging the backboard, the basketball standards. Well, in 3 inches, we can't anchor. We can't get a concrete anchor that works for the high loads that they will probably be putting on there. So this one, we had to make 4 inches thick just because of the end use. Not so much because of the it was required, but because in the end, we needed that. And these are 3 inches. These are classroom domes and the administration dome. Well, they're not hanging anything off the dome. And if it is, it's very light and very small. So we don't have to have that added thickness. So that all of that contributes to the design of the dome. Yeah.
Chris, when you put them on a, how much strength do you lose by going straight up rather than going full dome?
The dome part is a lot stronger than the stem walls.
Right. But I mean, what do you lose on the stem wall itself, or would you have to increase the?
Basically. The stem walls, they're gonna be, if this were a conventional building, then the stem walls would probably be lighter than what I've designed these here for, because I've designed these for the same loading. You know, I've used 150 mile an hour wind, so I've designed these stem walls for 150 mile an hour wind also, which
is,
these are 8-inch stem walls, but they're only 9 feet tall. So, and I've got, I think we're five on this one here, the gym where we have higher loading. I think we're number five verticals at 24 inches on center, so we've got some pretty good reinforcing. These are number fives at 48 with the smaller domes, but they're definitely not as strong as the dome, but they're plenty strong. There's there's no doubt that they are very strong. Yes.
So the collapsing forces are taken up by, presumably, a ring on the top of the stem.
Right, you've got a ring. Yeah, your ring being up here on the top of the stem.
So literally you're just sitting plate on top of the stem.
Really, yeah, exactly.
So there's no outward force.
There's no outward force. We're taking care of all of the outward force within our dome shell itself.
Right.
Yeah. Okay? So what physical feature has the biggest effect on the design? Anybody?
My wife.
That was
Absolutely correct.
Exactly, yeah, you're right. Openings. It's not to say you can't have openings, but the more and the larger openings that you have really affects things. It starts to act less like a shell and more like a post and beam, and so you get very thick, very quick, and it has a big thing. What's the next biggest one?
Closings.
Openings again, smart Alec. One more time. Openings. I have one more. It's not openings. Then we get to our geometry, whether it's the radius of curvature or the if it's an oblate ellipse or you know whatever you have. But openings really have a big, especially on a small diameter dome, you know, up to 50 feet that you would use for a home. I mean, openings. That has some shells with some good-sized openings. Now, didn't you design this one, Dr. Wilson?
Yeah.
This is called Eye of the Storm. It's in South Carolina. And just look at all of the cutouts here. That really cuts into your overall. It's still very strong, but what kind of thickness did you have to use? Do you remember that on some of those?
The shell itself is only about 3 or 4 inches, but yeah. Around the opening, it's all thickened and those piers that come down are thickened with whatever you are.
Lots of steel, exactly. So yeah, so the rest of the shell, but there's no openings, yeah, we can design, be very economical. That's the same thing here. This is, I designed this one. It's on the shore, I think it's Lake Michigan. It's where this column barber's did. Look at this enormous opening here. That's a two-story opening. They've got a second floor back here. It doesn't come out to this big window wall. But there is a ton of steel. You know, up in here, not so much, but right here, and then this is a big opening here too, just not as tall. But I think this was 9 or 10 inches thick around that opening. Just has a tremendous amount of steel. And then this, I hated this. The opening of this came down on top of this. The jam comes down on top of this opening. Boy, that was there's a congestion of steel right through there that is, it was just, the contractor was just bellyaching for a long time. And you guys had a fun experience with this shell too.
Yeah.
So they when they ordered the airform, it got ordered too short because it was from a previous design. And I think you flew out with somebody and fixed it on site. And so
it was a lovely day.
This is the Manitowoc.
Yes.
Yep.
So openings. I was gonna talk a little bit more technical about shell design. I've got to thank Danette for this presentation. She put this together. This kind of just shows you how the domes get their strength just because of their continuity, basically. You're taking an arch, take a flat piece and make it into an arch, and you gain a lot of strength because of its shape. And then as a dome, you rotate it around, and you've got that third degree of curvature, and it's even stronger than with just the arch. So this kind of shows some of the nomenclature that we use in dome design for the structures of it to figure out what forces are acting in each direction. And the neat thing about domes is that the forces act very, they're very directional. And so we can put steel and concrete in exactly the right places. The tension is all, you know, in hoop steel for the most part. And so we can align our steel up in that direction, exactly in the direction the tension is coming from. And that's very efficient. You know, we're not putting it at a 45 and all the tension's this way, but we're lining it right up so we can use less steel because it's already oriented in the right direction. Okay? go ahead.
Is the half sphere the most efficient compared to an elliptical? If you're just going for strength and efficiency.
Just for just based on strength, then yeah, a half sphere is very nice. Yes. There's you have to look at the whole picture sometimes because, you know, if you have a very large diameter and you have a half sphere, it's very tall. But just for strength, then yeah, a half sphere of no openings would be a great building. that'd be wonderful.
There's one in Dallas almost like this. Wasn't that a half sphere? The one that the guy got shot through on his original building?
I'd have to look at it. I can't remember. It's a 75 footer. Yeah. The one up near Fair Park.
Looks almost like a half sphere.
All right, so I've got a slide here, or a couple of, this is just some typical dome plans for a house. These are two 36-foot diameter domes. This one has a little, an opening for a small garage here. The things to look at, we've got, when your dome comes down to the ring beam, you've got tension in there. And so when we got two domes together, we interrupt that, so we have to put a grain beam across the middle to take that tension force across. And then we've got a few bearing walls here for some interior attic loads.
Are those done with a single airform, or did it have two airforms?
These were a single airform, yes.
So, just technically speaking, wouldn't it be better to separate them enough where they came to each have their own separate ring and have a doorway between them?
You know what? It's not going to make a difference here. You're not gaining anything structurally. Did you have a?
No, not the top. Let's say that.
Okay. So then this one had there's a little attic floor on the one side, just a mechanical plant. So here's a typical shell section. We got 4 inches thick up to 9 feet, and then it's 3 inches above that. I like to go with the 4 inches below because that's where all your openings are going to be in that, and they're all that covers all that. We could probably go with you know 3 inches all the way down, but you're going to be thickening up everywhere at the openings and stuff. So this is very typical. If you're building up to this is a 36 foot, a 40 foot or so, you're going to see this number 4 is vertical, 14 inches on center. Vertical and horizontal, and then up above a certain level, number 3 is at 15. I mean, that's just very, 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 very typical. So this is what you see. You can almost, for a home, a small diameter, you can plan on this, and that's gonna be the rebar and the concrete that you need for what, almost any size up to 40 feet, 45 feet, and then we're gonna start to get more. So here's just some typical details. We've got, here's our dome ring beam foundation. Now this one I had, I always get it wrong because some people want to cast this floor slab monolithic with the footing. It's not a big deal, it's just a different detail. Some people like to spray the shell first and then all of their overspray comes down and then they cast the floor on top of it and they've got a good subgrade. And they're the same detail, it's just, they're the same to me either way, but I always, no matter which detail I put on the plans, they'll come back, 3 months later when they're, we want to do it monolithically, and the building department needs to change it. Here's our grade beam at the dome intersection, showing this reinforcing coming through, and then here's a little bearing wall footing, just for that attic framing.
Could they hang that off the ceiling?
They could. You can hang. There's the thing that you want to be careful about whenever you're hanging something off the ceiling is redundancy, because if you're sitting on the floor, then it's not a big deal. All of your load path. But if you are hanging everything off the dome and you have one anchor failure, then you've got some issues if somebody's standing underneath it. Yeah, you gotta a combo bedroom kitchen, exactly. And so we can do that. We've done that on a lot of things. Mostly not like a whole second floor for the most part, but like catwalks and different things for auditoriums and stuff because they're around perimeter. But I would just be careful hanging the whole floor off of the upper shell, just because, you know, for that reason, you don't, if anything does, if were to ever happen, and it would have to, it could be the anchor or the tie rod or, you know, any part of that system, then, yeah, then you've got a catastrophic event.
One of the practical problems you have is if that second floor is hanging off the shell, the life thing, it always moves. That means that floor moves with it. So if you got something down there underneath, you're going to have some problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially towards the center of the shell, especially when you see, when you get when it heats up and cools down, you're going to have that expansion and contraction of the dome. Well, you don't really see that so much on the edges. I mean, it's moving, but you don't see it. But in the center, so if you have, if you're attached there with a solid connection, your floor is moving with that dome. That's, thank you. That's why he's here to keep me honest.
The piano bounce.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Go ahead.
Yeah, have you ever designed anything geometrically that's beyond longitudinal, latitudinal reinforcing bars, such as geodesics or triangular formations?
I've designed some geodesic domes. They're done with a panel system made by an outfit in Florida. The name escapes me now. You can probably tell me who it is.
Oh, that's a concrete.
American Ingenuity. Yeah, they have concrete on the outside, and but I quit doing those. It was just a whole lot more work and messy, and
Did you find it stronger though when you get into the interstices of a triangle?
No, you can't make it. It can't be stronger than the curved shape that's monolithically placed. I mean, you have all of your concrete placed almost homogeneously, and your rebar and stuff. Whenever you have, like with the American Ingenuity Dome, they're very good, very strong. But you know, they overlapped this wire that was coming out of their panels, and then they fill in the seams with a concrete mixture. Well, you've got a cold joint at every single one of those, and it's how do you justify that you've got enough overlap?
I'm sort of going beyond what the paneling system is rather than the consecutive use of hoops.
Uh-huh.
Like Buckminster Fuller's takes 32 great circles,
uh-huh,
puts them together, and finds that that's a stronger system than longitudinal, latitudinal hoop system.
You know, if you had, I mean, it would bear some research, you know, and maybe there is some validity to that. I don't have, in my experience, the dome is right up at the top of where you know structurally it'd be the strongest.
You were talking about hanging them from some ceiling. What are the kind of details you have to do to hang something like that?
You could hang it from a cable. Most of the time we've used a bar that's threaded on the ends that will put an anchor up there, either embedded in, but it's hard to shoot an anchor up in and get it in the right place, so we almost always have to come in and post-install it after the shell has been shot. And so we'll come up with an anchoring system with a number of anchor bolts and attached to a clevis with a bar coming down and then attached to another clevis at the floor to hold up the floor of the walkway.
And you try to put those so that they'd be like enclosed in the wall or something?
The ones that we've done that way have been, it was an auditorium, and we actually had it's in Gainesville, it's North Central Texas College, and we had it was like the sound booth that kind of sits up over it's a big auditorium stage. And then we had a catwalk that went up to the center of the dome where we had a proscenium stake to fly in all the stuff and for lights and different things. So it was just painted black up on the ceiling. It wasn't in a wall or anything. It was just all out exposed.
With the castle wall, I mentioned using it in commercial construction. Is it being used any in houses and smaller domes with the pluses and minuses?
I haven't seen any being used in houses. The castle wall that he's talking about, that's a non-mortar block that they've been experimenting with. I've done some calculations on the castle wall and some research on that, but I haven't I haven't been involved with one where we've actually used that. Everything's been mortar block and just typical CMU that we've used so far. We can make it as strong as you need, so it's not like it wouldn't be strong enough. And then the rest of anything after that, I don't care about. I just care that it's strong enough to stand up. Nobody calls me in the middle of the night. There we go. Okay, so here's some typical, here's the augment connection, here's a typical opening, here's the smaller opening that we had on that shell, and you can see the rebar that we placed around it, and where we had that big garage opening, we're thickening this area here to 5 inches all around this area, adding steel above and at the door jams. That's, you know, openings, that's what, they just interrupt all of these forces that are coming around, you know, especially your hoop forces. Well, now you have to take them over and under the opening. You have to get them around the opening somehow. And then you've got extra bending in your shell because you have the discontinuity. So that's how we take that out. And then here's a little saddle connection where we've got those two domes coming together and tying those in. And then we've got some connections for the wood, the 2x joists there for that little added framing.
Is that an example of how four loads tie into the dome then?
This one's a very, very simple one because it's just a little attic. I mean, sometimes we'll use a wood ledger that's segmented and put up, or sometimes, depending on what the loadings are, we'll just tie this as like a little clip angle that if the loads are small enough, we'll just tie that right into the dome shell itself and without a wood ledger, and I like using an adjustable bracket because as you go around your shell, then you've got a different angle at every point that your wood ties into it. So if you get a regular hanger, then you've got to, most of them are custom if they're bent to a certain degree, so you've got to, get them bent. Whereas if you can use some sort of clip, even if you have to go to a clip each side of that joist, that's better because you can feel bend them and just, stick it up there and bend it right and nail it in and use concrete anchors in concrete, or if we've got a wood ledger, then we'll use wood a wood screw or a connection there. So this is a very simplistic approach. Sometimes we've done corbels where we'll come in here and we'll put a corbel wrapped into the concrete here and you put a sill plate on it to set your
Horrible.
Concrete ledge.
It's like a ledge that you. It's a ledge that's right here, and you'll have some bars that come out into it, and then you'll spray those bars in, and so you have this ledge sprayed in place, and then you'll just come and set your joist down on top of it. Okay.
Basically, put cement footing in there, concrete.
Yeah, just halfway up your wall, right? Now there's some advantages and disadvantages. The advantages of you can just lay your joist out and go. Disadvantages, it's hard to form. And to spray in place. Some builders really enjoy it. I've got one guy that's all that he ever wants to do. And other people just hate it. It's terrible. We got to get it formed and that, blah, blah, blah. It's the builders. It goes down to their expertise, what they feel comfortable with. So we can design with a corbel, with the ledge, or without.
Shell get thicker than it from below that point, or does it stay the same?
Generally, the floor is right at the point where we're transitioning, and so I will always try to keep the shell thicker up through the floor, and then above that, it'll stay the same and thinner up top. Yeah. Okay.
It's about time.
Yeah. Go ahead.
At what point do you talk about your move? Just show what you did and talk about potential. At what point do you start getting, how long can you wait between
applications of shockcrete? Yeah. And that's interesting. We did a test while I was at school. Another graduate student did a test on that. And And they, what was the, you remember Joe Bingham's test there with the shotcrete layers? I think that some of them, he did some layers, and some of them he wet the concrete in between layers. Some of them, I think at some, didn't they dust some or something, or, and they we came out back with there was no differences in the shotcrete at all, because, and I think a lot of it has to do with the roughness of the shotcrete, and you're blowing it in, you're forcing it into all of the cracks and crevices, and it's a very rough surface anyway. We came back with, or Joe did on that we didn't have any, there's no evidence of any cold joint. He pulled them apart and tried to see where they broke. There's no correlation with any type of cold joint. Very, very interesting.
We built a little 32 foot dome all by hand.
Now see, by hand, I could see where you could really do that, because you can't force that in. You can't, you know.
Well, we threw it in. Well, my guys threw it out.
Yeah.
Good Mexican. Yeah. But we were wetting it. I'm just wondering just how much. Now I think we probably ended up with more thickness than what we needed, but we didn't get any blowback, so everything's on the dome. But I just wondered.
It was
pretty rough between.
Right, and that's, you know, I guess I would be. I mean, when we're talking about a 30 foot diameter dome, 32. They're pretty much bulletproof. I mean, you can do a whole lot of stuff to those little guys and not have any, you could show that the design would work for 3/4 inch thick, or, you know, 1 inch, but you can't ever get that, you know, with reinforcing it and everything. So I'm not really concerned, I wouldn't be concerned with a small dome like that.
I mean, we did a small input shell with that one. We poured it on 5 gallon buckets, and we were fine. We didn't have any problems.
Yeah.
Not even with BP.
Yeah, it's a locked to a scale, you know. If you start getting into a 160 footer, I'd be more concerned with, you know, just throwing it on by hand or but you really gain a lot with shotcrete that way, because you can really force that material up into up into the whole shell. So there's some real advantages to that. Construction material, shotcrete. Just talking about that. There's other ways that we can go. If you do an eco shell, certainly you can pour the concrete on the top. You got 5 gallon buckets here. You got throwing it on by hand. I think that especially as you get larger, shotcrete is just a good way to go. One thing that's gotten a lot of attention. Reinforcing, and I've seen a lot of people talking and about using fiber reinforcing and getting rid of replacing your rebar with fiber reinforcing and with PVA fibers or with steel fibers. I'm going to tell you right now, don't believe any of it. The people that are saying that, I don't know where they get. I've read some stuff on the monolithic side, and somebody brought to my attention, because I don't have time to blog or do that. I don't know. I just don't have any aptitude for that. And what do you think he's saying? All this stuff. And I read, and I said, you'd be crazy if you did that. We've had some shells that have been. We experimented with doing some fibers. And they haven't been super successful. There's some research that by adding PVA fibers, those are the little synthetic fibers, you can help with some rebound, and you get more of your concrete up on the wall. And for that purpose, then maybe they're good. I don't know if that's true or not. But for reinforcing steel, even if you're using steel fibers, they say, well, you get 50 pounds of these steel fibers per yard equals, number of 4 bars at 12 inches on center. Well, that might be true in a floor slab where everything's getting. But you don't see people build bridges like that. And the fibers are all oriented like this. And we know where our stresses are. You know, that's the crazy thing. I mean, if you could guarantee me that we would have a certain percentage of fibers that were oriented this way and lapping, then I'd say, okay, go ahead. But we can't do that. They're going to be sprayed, they're going to be sticking out of the plane and this way and that way.
So you have to have your super conducting magnet.
Yeah. If you can do that, I would say, you know, that's something that I would be open to looking at. But there's many, many people that are hawking that right now, saying, hey, you know, we need to go to fiber reinforcement, it can be cheaper, blah, blah, blah. And don't fall for that. There's another thing that I like to bring up is that I worked for my uncle for a while after high school in a mine. And since he was my uncle, I got the good job. And so I was running a jackhammer, tearing out slabs and things. And I wanted to be on the backhoe, you know, moving the rubble. But no, I've torn apart floor slabs that we've used fibers on, and floor slabs that have rebar in them. And you cannot convince me that they're the same. I mean, it's a pain. I mean, it's so hard to break up this floor slab that has a big mat of steel in it, even 4-12. Fibers, you could just bust through that, and I mean, you can go through a big old, you know, you go through this size of room here in a day. And when you got the when you've got reinforcing bars in there, there's no way. I mean, it's a light labor, you know, laborious process. And so I know from experience that, you know, it's not the same. You know, there's all of these people with tests and with data. Oh, it's the same. It's not the same. So just throwing that out there for anyone that might be tempted to believe that it's like, you know, they say if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I think that there's a good deal of that with fibers.
I'd like to second that very strongly. Over the last 40 years, there's been a handful of domes that have had some problems with the fibers. One fellow with a different system built some up through Colorado, went back and rebuilt them at his own cost later on, because every one of them, they were salt storage, small salt storage, because they all had failures.
Very good. Very good. And, go ahead,
Chris. Is there anything other than anecdotal comments or evidence that the PVA fibers will reduce rebound?
Someone had told me at one point that there was a study, and I haven't seen it, okay. So I can't say.
So really, it's just anecdotal. We know.
As far as I know.
The polyfiber type, there are some studies that show it cuts the rebound some.
And that's all I know. Another thing about shock creep, some people, and I've had people ask me about this, of using a lightweight aggregate, so you can get a lighter product, you know, for different reasons. Once again, not a very good idea unless you come up with a different way of applying it. The experience that we've had is that when they use an expanded shale aggregate for lightweight concrete, which it, you know, can be strong enough. But when you pump it through a nozzle, it forces the water inside of all of those, and everything inside all the voids. So you have to add more water to get it pumpable. Well, when you add more water, you get less strength. And so I think there have been one or two domes done that David has done with lightweight aggregate, and they were not positive. I think they had significant. They lasted a long time for some of them, but it wasn't there one in Utah.
The lightweight causes lots of problems, mostly with the guy that's trying to pump it. As soon as he turns that on, it plugs up everything he's got. Pre-soak some of them, and they get some results with pumping, but again, your pressures are higher with shooting, causes lots of the problems.
So that would be, it's a lot more efficient. If you're going to come, if you need a light product for some reason, I know one guy wanted to build these little tiny modules, and so we want them light so they can put them on a truck and move them. We need to come up with something besides the expanded shale, I guess. It's a lightweight aggregate that you could use and still pump, or else you've got to apply it, and, you know, you can apply it by hand or, you know, whatever. But as soon as you apply pressure to it, it just you have a hard time with lightweight concrete. Am I 5 minutes? that is the end of what I had prepared. Does anybody have any questions or comments or concerns? Or yeah, go ahead.
What would be the ideal size, not lightweight, or the size magazine that you want to use in the dome shelf?
Usually a 3/8 and minus. 3/8 pea gravel or works real well. And a lot of times on the last layers, they'll use a sand-only mixture to give it a nice smooth.
I can tell you from experience, the more 3/8 that you use, the more rebar.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a lot harder to make it smooth when it's in the last layer. You know, use sand only or something.
Yes?
The burming, how much more, is there more reinforcement?
The biggest thing about burming or covering it is the footing. Because you're adding significant weight to the top of the shell. And if you don't have a wide enough footing, it's going to be like a cookie cutter, just drill it down through. And so we need to thicken that footing up and make sure that we're wide enough so that it floats, you know, as we're on. You know.
Do you guys require, say you were an engineer or something like that, would you require a soil test?
I love soil analysis. I love to have the geotechnical guy go out and take a look at it because you just don't know. We get here in Texas and Oklahoma, boy, there's some horrible, horrible soils. And if you were to just go out and build something, I mean, you don't know. I mean, and there's kind of a line down the state. And on one side of it, you're doing all right. The other side is just, the stuff moves and expands. And, you know, and so I'm always in favor of having a geotechnical person look at it and say, okay, yeah, here's what you need to look at. Or that's my experience. I'll go ahead.
In general, how difficult is it to convince building officials translating the design counts that you do to building code?
It depends kind of on where you're at. If you're in California, it can be very difficult. It just kind of depends. I've had really good luck with it. I've kind of got a system down where I use a lot of this stuff that Nanette put together for me. Where's that one with the that showed the force diagram and stuff, and she's put together a really good explanation on that, and I'll include that with calculations, and then one thing that I love to do is to just bury them with a thing of if they come back and say, well, show that this works, I will just print out 300 sheets of math stuff, and. And then, I've never had that come back and people say, well, okay. I've gone through and I've spent months and months trying to convince people, well, here's how it works. And, well, we don't believe that, do this. So you do this. Now here's how it works. And you don't. And so now, when especially when I know which jurisdiction it is, San Diego County, California, they're horrible. LA County, they're bad. And so I will send in this package of calculations just as thick as I can pad it up. And you know what? They have, the reality is they have no idea. And they'll look at it. They don't want to look super stupid. They'll just say, okay. Well, but they always come back with something. Well, provide a shear force distribution or a rigid diaphragm analysis. And I'll say, it's on page 386. And they open up, oh, well, yeah, okay. Because the reality is, it's very, very difficult math. Fortunately, I don't have to do it every day because somebody else solved all those equations. And I've got, I had the class, and for the most part, it's a spreadsheet, but it's knowing when and where to use all of the different things that is difficult. That is, that's what I get paid for. You know, a trained monkey could do my job 95% of the time. But it's those few times when you don't fit the exact formula and you've got to use engineering judgment. That's when, that's where my expertise comes in.
So you're saying most of your salary is only for 5% of your time?
Exactly. Yeah. The rest of it goes to my trained monkeys.
Just 4 or 5%.
Yeah. Yeah. The 5% is only what I spend on your job. Anything else? Oh, yeah.
Do we ever pair them?
What's that?
Do you ever pair them?
Pair the domes?
With a pair.
Oh, with a pier. Oh, yeah, like sitting on, like raising the domes up off the ground or putting a pier down below.
Yeah, down below in the ground.
We've done that.
The soil is bad.
Yes.
It's like gumbo kind
of. Yes, exactly. We've done that a number of times in here in Texas. But we've also had good luck with, if we can get an alternate from the geotechnical people, about over-excavating a site and bringing in 3 or 4 or 5 feet of fill, especially around the ring beam. Domes work very well because they're so stiff and they're not susceptible to differential settlement or movement. If you have a tiny bit of force over here that might really crack the corner of a conventional wood frame house or stucco or something, your whole dome is stiff enough that it moves all together, and we haven't had a lot of issues with that. But soils is such a big deal that, you know, sometimes we've had to go with that, a suspended slab and a...
So do you overestimate, do you put in a lower plasticity, lower plasticity?
Yeah, we'll bring in a structural fill that's well-graded gravel, and that gets rid of the clay, exactly.
How about the flat work inside? Is that sitting on the... That's actually setting some, well, it looks like it's setting on the...
Well, it will, or we'll make a joint if it's really bad soil, so that it's a free-floating slab, so it's not tied to the shell at all. Yeah.
Would you pair that?
So, we've had to before, yes. But, I mean, and that just depends on local conditions, exactly. If they come back and say, yeah, you've got this black gumbo, it adds a lot of cost to the project, but that's what you have to do to make a something that's going to be last and be a good...
Because the black gumbo, you know, it's up in the 40s.
Yeah, you got all this real high swell when it gets wet. So, another thing that we've done to help with that too is to put a cutoff wall around the outside of the dome so that we go down 4 or 5 feet with a lean fill concrete, so that it makes a moisture barrier so that you don't get the infiltration of water, so then the soil in the middle can't physically heat because it's not getting wet. And so that's another thing that we look at. But all of those things are things that we have to work out with the geotechnical engineer. I can't make those decisions on my own because I rely on his expertise. If he says that's not going to work, then yeah, we go to an elevated slab that's, you know, on cardboard, you know.
I'll do that.
All right, I guess I'm done.
Thank you very much, Chris.
All right. Thanks for coming.